You know, there's certain sounds in theater that just they trigger a memory. If you're a Broadway fan, you know exactly what I mean.
Oh, for sure.
The first organ notes of Phantom, the opening roar of The Lion King. But there's one sound effect that is arguably more famous than the music itself.
The helicopter.
The helicopter.
Yeah.
The whirring blades, the wind actually hitting you in the front row.
Oh.
Today we are talking about the show that literally landed a chopper on stage 8 times a week.
We are talking about Miss Saigon.
A giant of a show.
And I don't use that word lightly. I mean, it broke box office records before it even opened. It turned the British mega musical into a global brand.
But it also turned the theater world completely upside down.
And not always in a good way.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is, well, it's complicated. We're looking at Miss Saigon as this massive cultural paradox.
It really is.
Because on one hand, you have a show with these soaring ballads that people absolutely love. It's a tearjerker.
A huge emotional impact. The show is designed to wreck you.
But on the other hand, you have, what, decades of protests, academic critiques, and really intense debates about race, representation, and history.
It is a lightning rod. And I think if you only know the songs or you just remember the spectacle, you might be missing the real story here.
So we've combed through a comprehensive overview of the musical's history, the production notes, the plot, the financial records, and of course, the critical reception as of early 2026.
Right.
We're going to unpack why this show, which premiered way back in 1989, is still such a heated topic of conversation.
It's a fascinating ride. We have to look at the money, the yellow face controversy, and the underlying message about, the American dream.
Let's start with the guys who built this machine, because it sounds familiar, doesn't it? If you close your eyes and listen to the orchestrations, it just feels like Les Miserables.
It definitely shares that DNA. It's the French duo, Claude Michel Schoenberg and Alain Buble. And you have to remember, in the mid-80s, they were on top of the world.
Right, Les Mis was a juggernaut.
Exactly. They had practically invented the modern sung-through mega musical.
Okay, just to pause there. Sung through. For anyone who isn't a theater nerd, that
Yeah.
means no talking, right?
Exactly. No spoken dialogue. The entire story, every transition, every argument is set to music. It creates this relentless, sweeping emotional current. And after the success of Les Mis, they were looking for their next vehicle for that style.
And inspiration struck in a really specific, really heartbreaking way.
It did. Schoenberg was flipping through a magazine and he saw a picture. It was taken at Tan Son Hoat Air Base in Vietnam, and it was a photo of a Vietnamese mother leaving her child at the departure gate.
And the context here is just, it's crucial. The child's father was an ex-GI.
Right. And in post-war Vietnam, mixed-race children faced significant discrimination, a lot of hardship. So this mother, she knew that sending her child away was the only way to guarantee a better life, or at least a safer life in the U.S. with the father.
So she was sending the child away and staying behind.
Knowing she would likely never see her child again. Exactly. Schoenberg called that action the ultimate sacrifice.
And that phrase, that basically became the seed for the entire show.
It did.
But here's where the entertainment part kicks in. They didn't just write a docudrama about that photo. They decided to map that emotion onto one of the most famous structures in opera history.
Madama Butterfly, Giacomo Puccini's 1904 opera. It's a very deliberate relocation of that story. They took the story of a Japanese geisha and an American naval officer, and they moved it to 1970s Vietnam. So Pinkerton from the opera becomes Chris Scott, an American Marine.
And Butterfly becomes Kim, a 17-year-old war orphan.
Which brings us to the plot. And we have to go through this because the specific plot points are what generate both the tears and, the anger.
Right. It opens in a place called Dreamland.
Which sounds lovely, but it is. It is
Yep.
definitely not. It's a sleazy bar and brothel in Saigon, right on the eve of the city falling in 1975.
And this is where we meet the character who arguably steals the whole show.
The engineer.
Yeah, the engineer.
He's the MC, the pimp, the hustler running the joint. He is Eurasian, half French, half Vietnamese, and he is desperate, absolutely desperate to get to the United States.
Right.
He views America not just as a country, but as this mythical land of commerce and luxury and Cadillac.
But Kind is new at Dreamland. It's her first day. The engineer throws her into a Miss Saigon contest.
Which is basically a beauty pageant to sell the women to the GIs. And Chris, the American Marine, is there. He's disillusioned with the war. He's tired. His buddy buys him a night with Kim.
Which is I mean, that's a rough way to start a romance story.
It is, and the show leans into that discomfort, but then pivots really quickly to romance. They fall in love almost instantly. They have a wedding ceremony right there in the bar, and for a moment, the music makes you believe they can transcend the war.
But the war has other ideas. Kim actually has a cousin, Thu.
Thu is the antagonist here. He was betrothed to Kim years ago by their parents. He's now an officer in the North Vietnamese Army.
So he tracks her down.
He does. He tries to claim her. But the chaos of the war just interrupts everything.
And this leads to the scene, the moment the show is famous for, the fall of Saigon.
April 1975. So in the timeline of the show, this is actually a flashback that happens in Act Two, but it's the pivotal trauma that drives the whole narrative. The Viet Cong are closing in. The U.S. embassy is evacuating.
And this is where the engineering marvel comes in.
Yeah.
Because back in 1989, they didn't rely on screens or projections.
Yeah, no, this was practical magic. They built a realistically scaled helicopter. It descended from the grid. The blades were spinning. The noise was deafening.
I heard it physically blew air into the audience.
It did. It was designed to overwhelm the senses. It solidified Miss Saigon as a spectacle. You weren't just watching a play, you were witnessing an event.
And in that chaos,
Chris is physically pulled into the helicopter to escape, and Kim is left behind at the gates, screaming.
It's devastating. And visually, later in the show, they counterbalance this with another massive set piece, right? The giant statue of Ho Chi Minh.
Yes, the Morning of the Dragon sequence. It's huge, militaristic, and intimidating. It creates this massive contrast between the American exit and the North Vietnamese arrival.
So the helicopter leaves, Chris is gone, and we jump forward 3 years.
Act Two, it's 1978. Kim is still in Vietnam. She's living in poverty, and she has a son, Tam.
Chris's son.
Chris's son. She is fiercely protective of him, waiting for Chris to come back.
And the engineer is still hanging around.
Still trying to use the kid as his ticket out.
Oops.
Exactly. He figures a mixed-race child of an American GI is his passport. They eventually flee to Bangkok.
But the audience knows something Kim doesn't.
Chris has moved on.
He has. He's back in the States. He's suffering from what we now call PTSD, but he's rebuilt his life.
And he has an American wife named Ellen.
And this is the collision course. Chris and Ellen go to Bangkok to find Kim. They meet. And the reality just crashes down on Kim.
Right. He isn't there to take her back to America to be his wife. He's married.
It's the ultimate culture clash and tragedy. Kim realizes that she has no place in Chris's American life. But, and this is key, she wants her son to have that life.
She refuses to let Tam stay in poverty in Asia.
So she confronts them.
It's messy. Chris and Ellen offer financial support. They want to help, but they aren't immediately saying, yes, we'll take the boy and raise him. So Kim decides that the only way to force their hand, the only way to guarantee her son goes to America, is if she is removed from the equation.
The ultimate sacrifice.
She goes behind a curtain. A gunshot is heard. She falls. She dies in Chris's arms. The engineer looks on, realizing his meal ticket is gone, but the boy is going to America.
Wow. It is heavy. I mean, it is tragic opera through and through.
It is.
And clearly, it worked. The audience response was, it was insane.
The numbers are staggering. When it transferred from London to Broadway in 1991, it set a record for advance ticket sales, $39 million.
In 1991 money, that is astronomical.
That's like the GDP of a small country.
Basically,
it ran for 10 years on Broadway, over 4,000 performances. As of our check in 2026, it is still the 15th longest running show in Broadway history.
And the awards piled up. Lea Salonga, who played Kim, became an international superstar. Jonathan Pryce, who played the engineer, won the Tony.
Though, fun fact, it actually lost Best Musical that year to the Will Rogers Follies.
Which nobody remembers.
Which is ironic, right? Miss Saigon lost the trophy but won the history books.
However, and this is a massive however, that success came with immediate, intense controversy. You really can't talk about Miss Saigon without talking about the casting fight of 1990.
Absolutely not. This was huge. I feel like this story is often told as just a footnote, but it was a watershed moment for Asian representation.
It really was, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So here's the situation. The show starts in London. Jonathan Pryce is cast as the engineer.
And Pryce is a white Welsh actor.
Right. And the character is Eurasian, half French, half Vietnamese.
And in London, this wasn't just blind casting. They actually changed his appearance.
They did. Pryce wore prosthetics to change the shape of his eyes. He wore heavy bronzing cream.
That's yellow face.
That is literally the definition of yellow face.
Yep.
And in London, it largely slid by. But when they got ready to bring the show to New York, the climate was different. The Actors Equity Association, the union for actors in the U.S., stepped in and said no.
They barred him.
They did. They denied permission for Price to reprise the role. And their argument was twofold.
Okay.
First, the prosthetics and makeup were an affront to the Asian community. It was a caricature. Second, they argued that casting a white star in one of the few major roles written for an Asian character was denying opportunity to Asian actors.
And this wasn't just the union being difficult. There were some heavy hitters involved.
Prominent voices, David Henry Hwang, the playwright who wrote M. Butterfly, and actor B.D. Wong, wrote these passionate letters protesting the casting. They called it demeaning. They basically said, we are not costumes.
So you have the moral high ground on one side.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, you have Cameron McIntosh, the producer.
And he didn't blink. He played hardball. You have to understand McIntosh's power at this time. He had Cats, Les Mis, Phantom. He was the king of Broadway.
So he says what?
He told the union, if I can't have Jonathan Pryce, I'm canceling the show.
Despite the $39 million in the bank.
He was willing to walk away. Or at least he bluffed well enough. He canceled the production. He pulled the plug.
That puts the union in a terrible spot.
Yeah.
Suddenly, thousands of jobs, musicians, stagehands, ushers are on the line.
Exactly. The pressure from the public who wanted to see the show and just the sheer economic weight of it crushed the protest.
Yeah.
The Actors Equity Association reversed its decision.
They caved.
They caved. So Price performed. Now, crucially, for the Broadway run, they dropped the eye prosthetics and the bronzer.
Oh, God.
He played the role in his own skin, and he was acclaimed for it. He won the Tony Award.
So he won the battle, but did the war change things?
It did. Even though the show went on, the conversation had shifted permanently. It forced the industry to look in the mirror about yellowface and casting equity. It was the moment where people stopped saying, it's just acting, and started asking, who gets to tell these stories?
And there was a secondary controversy too, wasn't there, with Leah Salonga.
Yes, briefly. Leah Salonga is Filipina, and the union initially hesitated to let her perform because she wasn't an American citizen. But in that case, they realized there was simply no American actress who could sing that role the way she did. She was undeniable.
You'd think after 1991, things would settle down. But the protests didn't stop.
Not at all. It followed the show everywhere. College students protested in 1994 at St. Olaf College. There were cancellations of panel discussions as recently as 2019 in Madison, Wisconsin.
So once the casting issue was settled, the criticism moved to the writing itself.
Exactly.
Okay, let's dig into that. Beyond the casting, what is the core intellectual problem people have with the show? Is it just, can you define that for us in this context?
Sure. It's the idea that the West views the East through a lens of stereotypes as exotic, submissive, dangerous, or backward. Scholars like Yu Tian Rong argue that Miss Saigon reinforces a very specific, damaging stereotype. Asia as a place that is effeminized and infantized.
A place that needs saving.
Precisely. Wong argues the show depicts Vietnam basically as a whorehouse for the West. I mean, look at the setting. Dreamland.
Right.
The critique is that the show presents prostitution as just the norm, the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It erases the historical reality that the war itself and the American presence was what forced many of these women into poverty and sex work.
It normalizes it as just how things are over there.
Exactly. And then there's Kim. She's the heroine, but she's also a trope.
Lotus Blossom.
The submissive Asian woman who is pure, self-sacrificing, and exists entirely to love a white man.
I saw a really interesting point in the notes from scholar Karen Shimakawa about the wedding scene.
Oh, this is fascinating. So think about that wedding in the bar. For Chris, the American, what is it?
It's a party.
Yeah.
It's a night out. He's with his buddies.
Exactly. It's a spectacle. But for Kim, she views it as binding. She considers herself his wife.
Mm.
Shimakawa argues that the narrative of the musical actually validates the American legal system over the Vietnamese custom. Later, when we meet Ellen, she is the legal wife. The show treats the Vietnamese marriage as a fantasy and the American marriage as reality.
It treats Vietnam as a memory and America is the future.
Right. It reinforces the idea that the West is real and legitimate and the East is just a tragic backdrop for the white man's emotional journey.
That is a strong critique.
Yeah.
But playing devil's advocate here, or maybe just representing the average ticket buyer, millions of people adore this show. Frank Rich at the New York Times, the most powerful critic of his era, gave it a glowing review.
He did. And his review captures the tension perfectly. He called it gripping entertainment. His argument was basically that the craft, the lush melodies, the staging, the performances was so good that it overrode the shallow lyrics or the stereotypical characters.
So the art was good enough to mask the politics?
For many people, yes. And we have to acknowledge, the show has launched careers. Leah Salonga, Eva Noblezada. It has provided massive star-making roles for Asian actresses in an industry that, frankly, often ignores them.
So that's the complexity.
You can hate the stereotype, but love the opportunity it created.
Now, the show hasn't stayed frozen in amber since 1989. The creators have heard this feedback, right? Have they tweaked it?
They have. They haven't rewritten the core story, but they've adjusted the edges. The biggest change is usually around Ellen, the American wife.
Because in the original, she was a bit hard to like.
A little defensive, yeah. She had a song called Now That I've Seen Her, where she basically stakes her claim on Chris. In the 2014 revival, they scrapped that song. They replaced it with a ballad called Maybe.
And how does that change the character?
It makes her more sympathetic, more nuanced. She's grappling with the moral weight of the situation rather than just fighting for her man. They also scrubbed some of the lyrics that felt a bit fake Asian, like references to the little god of my heart.
Trying to ground it a bit more.
Trying. But the skeleton of the show, the suicide, the white savior narrative, that remains.
What about a movie? I mean, we got the Les Mis movie with Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway. Mm. Miss Saigon seems like a no-brainer for Hollywood.
You would think. It's been in what Hollywood calls development hell for decades. There were rumors Lee Daniels was going to direct it. Cameron McIntosh keeps hinting at it, often saying it depended on the financial success of the Les Mis film.
So why haven't we seen it?
The source material suggests it's the cultural climate. Adapting the story now, with all the baggage we've just discussed, is a minefield.
Right.
To do it faithfully to the stage show risks backlash. To change it too much risks alienating the fans. It's a very expensive risk.
So here we are. We have a show that is statistically one of those successful things humans have ever put on a stage. It has songs like I Still Believe and The American Dream that people belt out in their cars.
Absolutely.
But it's also this massive symbol of exclusion and stereotyping.
It forces us to ask, whose story is this? It's a story about Vietnam, but it's written by two Frenchmen. It's based on an Italian opera, and it centers on an American soldier.
When you put it that way, the lens gets pretty distorted.
The expert view here is that you can enjoy the craft of it. It is a well-oiled machine. But you have to grapple with how it tells history. It turns the tragedy of a nation into a backdrop for a romance.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave the listener with one specific thought to chew on. We keep coming back to that phrase, the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Kim dying so her son can go to America. The show frames this as the ultimate act of maternal love. It is the emotional climax.
But flip that around for a second. Really think about the implication.
Right.
Does the musical suggest that life in America is the only life worth living? That death-suicide is preferable to raising a child in Vietnam?
It's a stark message when you put it like that.
It's a dramatic ending, sure. But ask yourself, what does that plot point say about how the West views the rest of the world? Is the American dream really the only dream there is?
Or is that just the only dream the writers could imagine?
That is the question. Thanks for diving in with us. We'll see you on the next one.
Take care.